2 years. I think it was Colin and Catherine's very first sort of encounter with the church was the last time we were here a couple of years ago in a pub. I've sort of been with you when you were back in the Arts Centre and so on, but this is the first time I see you in the larger setting here, a bit more space for people to run and move around. I've known Jonathan and Sarah for sort of 5 or 6 years, so I try to keep in touch with them and provide what support we can. I currently lead the church in north of Milton Keynes, so I've been doing that since 2003. My wife Helen's there, and I also brought Paul and Heather. I think you've had a few other people from church over the last 6 weeks or so. So I think we sent Danny and Roger. You've got our retired Baptist minister. And Den was the other one, wasn't he? With his story of recovery from leukemia. The thing that most shaped me was that as a child I had terrible, terrible asthma. Really, really bad. It was so bad that when I was 15... they sent me off to a high altitude clinic in Switzerland for a year. It was so bad that throughout my childhood, I never knew whether each breath would be my last. I liked football. I liked to run around. I didn't get the opportunity. If I took more than about 3 paces running, then I was gasping for breath. And I would be in trouble. The only place I could ever play in football was goalkeeper, because it was sort of 2 paces that way and then 2 paces that way, and the only thing I could do. But what the consequence of the asthma was, it caused me to think out an awful lot about sort of what life was about, why are we here. It made me slow down, and I now look back on those years with gratitude, because it helped me get my sort of eternal perspective and future sorted out. Just because I couldn't rush around and ignore that bigger picture. Yeah. As a child, I always believed what I understood. And as a child, I didn't understand very much. When I was from 7 till 13, I sang in a church choir of an Anglican church. I remember at the age of 11, standing in the church porch and asking myself, why are we called Christians? We should be called Godians, because we believe in God. I was intensely logical, and I had no understanding where Jesus fitted into it at all. Right? At 12, I remember singing an anthem by John Arland, which includes the verse from John 15:13. Greater love has no man this than a man lay down his life for his friends. And I remember thinking, yes, that's true. I cannot think of anything greater that a man could do than lay down his life for his friends. But at that point, I didn't connect it with Jesus at all. No concept that was talking about what Jesus had done for us. When I was 15, I went to this clinic in Switzerland, met some Christians there. They gave me a contact of a good church in Watford. I came back from the time in Switzerland and did nothing about it for 2 years. When I was 18, I was coming home from school one day. I was coming across this causeway between the lakes, some lakes, which meant that I knew there was nobody within shouting distance of me. And I heard this voice say, "It's time to go to church again." And I was looking around, where did that come from? Yeah, sort of completely out of the blue. And so I did nothing about it. For another 3 months, whilst I did my A-levels, and after that, I got involved with St. Mary's Church in Watford. And I had an awful lot of knowledge from my childhood. And as God brought revelation, I grew very rapidly in those first 2 or 3 years. So things like, I knew that verse about greater love has no man than this, a man laid down his life for his friends. And as God brought revelation, that, oh, that's about Jesus. I grew very, very rapidly as all these things fell into place. Yeah. So, but one of my little mantras is sort of knowledge plus revelation equals growth. Knowledge on its own is not, yeah. Knowledge plus revelation equals understanding, right? That's not quite enough. Understanding plus application equals growth. Right? So that's why we pray for revelation, and we also pray that people will be willing to put it into practice. Right? There can be a big gap between, we can understand it, but are we willing to do something about it as well? Okay? So, I've been married to Helen for more than a quarter of a century. 26 years. I worked for the railways for 22 years from when I left uni. And then about 6 years ago, we were planting a church in the south of the city. The previous senior leader went to lead that. And we were praying about sort of what we should do about, you know, who should take over leading the church. And I'd known for the previous 2 or 3 years that I wasn't going to be working for the railways that much longer. And just became apparent that it became obvious that it should be me. So I resigned, took a rather large pay cut, and came to lead the church in Milton Keynes. So thanks for the opportunities, by the way, for having other people to speak here. It's one of my issues is that I've actually got a lot of people. I think we've got something like 8 people who used to lead churches, and 9 people are either sort of elders or assistant pastors. And then we're trying to raise up a whole load of other people, and that puts quite a lot of pressure on opportunities, actually. What God's spoken to me about is building a big base church and then planting out from that. So we know who will be first up for planting. It'll be Steve Murrell, and he will be gone in 2 to 3 years' time. And our aim is that he'll take 30, 40 people, so he actually gets going with a good base. I think of the vineyard in Milton Keynes where they planted with basically Matt arrived from Oxford. There was him, his wife, and the phone number of someone who might join them. Right? You know, starting like that is just so painful and hard work. Yeah. So that's our aim. That's our sort of big picture strategy. So anyway, that's just give you a little bit of a feel for us. For me, I'm going to then just sort of get into talking about King Solomon, a good start with a bad finish. And I'm actually going to look at the whole of his life in one session. His name means peace. He was the younger son of King David, and he ruled the kingdom of Israel from about 1015 BC to 975 BC, or about, in other words, about 3,000 years ago. He had a turbulent childhood. He was the son of Bathsheba, and she was the woman that King David had committed adultery with and whose first husband, David, had killed. When he was about 10, he lived through his brother Absalom's rebellion when Absalom tried to take the throne from his father David. And that would not have been good news for Solomon as a younger brother if Absalom had succeeded. When his father was old and dying, another brother, Adonijah, had rebelled to take the throne, again trying to take it from David in his dying days. And of David's many sons, Solomon was the one that David had promised his mother Bathsheba that he would be king after David. So let's start with 3 features of his good start. If you've got a Bible, I'd like you to turn with me to 1 Kings, first book of Kings, chapter 3 and verses 4 to 13. And while you're looking, I'll take the opportunity of praying. Father, I pray that as we look at this today, I pray that you will bring not just knowledge, but also revelation. Lead us to understanding and give us application. Father, help us to be willing to put into practice what you speak to our hearts about. Father, be with us. Use my words. Help me to learn new things from this as much as everybody else. In Jesus' name. 1 Kings 3, verses 4 to 13. The king went to Gibeon to offer sacrifices, for that was the most important high place. And Solomon offered 1,000 burnt offerings on that altar. At Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon during the night in a dream. And God said, "Ask for whatever you want me to give you." Solomon answered, "You have shown great kindness to your servant, my father David, because he was faithful to you and righteous and upright in heart. You've continued this great kindness to him and have given him a son to sit on his throne this very day. Now, O Lord my God, you've made your servant king in place of my father David. But I am only a little child and do not know how to carry out my duties. Your servant is here among the people you've chosen, a great people too numerous to count or number. So give your servant a discerning heart to govern your people and to distinguish between right and wrong. For who is able to govern this great people of yours?" The Lord was pleased that Solomon had asked for this. So God said to him, "Since you've asked for this and not for long life or wealth for yourself, nor have asked for the death of your enemies, but for discernment in administering justice, I'll do what you've asked. I will give you a wise and discerning heart, so that there will never have been anyone like you, nor will there ever be. Moreover, I'll give you what you've not asked for, both riches and honour, so that in your lifetime you will have no equal among kings." So Solomon sought to grow as a person, and in that he acknowledged his inexperience and his limitations. He acknowledges God's sovereignty. He's saying, God put him there, verse 7, "You have made your servant king." He understands his lack of knowledge. Verse 7 again, "I do not know how to carry out my duties." He displays an excellent level of humility, and he asks for wisdom. And God's pleased with him for humbling himself and seeking wisdom, verse 10. And God then gives him a wise and discerning heart. It's summed up in chapter 4 and verses 29 and 30. If you want to look at those. God gave Solomon wisdom and very great insight, and breadth of understanding as measureless as the sand on the seashore. Solomon's wisdom was greater than the wisdom of all the men of the East, and greater than all the wisdom of Egypt. See, Solomon started well. He knew his limitations, he knew his inexperience, and he sought to grow as a person. They're all good features. Secondly, second part of the good things, the features of his good start, was that he built well on what he'd been given. He has an inheritance from his father, the kingdom. Lots of resources. In fact, David was stockpiling resources ready for the temple to be built. And he goes on to use this wisdom and discernment to do a lot of good work. Chapters 5 and 6 talk about the 7 years during which he built God's temple. Chapter 7 talks about the 13 years that he then uses to build his palace. And in chapter 8, you'll find the Ark of the Covenant representing God's presence is brought to the temple and dedicated there. If I'm going to get through the whole life, some parts, I'm going to have to go at that pace. Solomon holds nothing back in resources or effort in his service of God and in his development of his kingdom. Okay? So that's the second part. He built well on what he'd been given. A third part of his good and positive start was that he brought prosperity and peace to the kingdom. And they enabled him to pursue many interests. So you'll read of architecture and agriculture and botany and philosophy, music. He wrote 1,005 songs, of which 5 are in the Bible. And above all, in terms of what's left for posterity, is literature. Solomon writes 3 very different books that are included in the Bible. There's the Song of Songs. Love poetry, written in the brightness of youth. There's Proverbs, practical thought and wisdom, written in the middle age, the middle years. And there's Ecclesiastes, the great retribution, the meaningless of everything unless God's acknowledged. And a sad book, reflecting Solomon's sad ending. So he brought prosperity and peace. In fact, in chapters 9 and 10, you'll see his wisdom and splendour displayed. And they can only develop like that because there's such prosperity and peace. And it ends, chapter 10, verses 23 to 27, ends with a summary description of that wealth and wisdom, especially verse 23. So, King Solomon was greater in riches and wisdom than all the other kings of the earth. The whole world sought audience with Solomon to hear the wisdom God had put in his heart. Year after year, everyone who came brought a gift. Articles of silver and gold, robes, weapons, spices, horses and mules. Solomon accumulated chariots and horses. He had 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horses, which he kept in the chariot cities and also with him in Jerusalem. The king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stones, and cedar as plentiful as sycamore fig trees in the foothills. God gives Solomon great riches and wisdom. Verse 23, more than any other king. Verse 24, others sought him out. So far, he is doing great. He's sought to grow. He's built well on what he's been given. He's brought prosperity and peace. And he's certainly getting plenty of reward. Wisdom and honour, wealth and riches. That'll sound interesting on the tape. But then the tone changes. Things start to go horribly wrong. And the roots of this are right back at the beginning. Turn with me back to chapter 3 and verses 1 to 3. So 1 Kings 3 still. Verses 1 to 3. Solomon made an alliance with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and married his daughter. He brought her to the city of David until he finished building his palace and the temple of the Lord and the wall around Jerusalem. The people, however, were still sacrificing at the high places because a temple had not yet been built for the name of the Lord. Solomon showed his love for the Lord by walking according to the statutes of his father David, except that he offered sacrifices and burned incense on the high places. In verse 1, he married Pharaoh's daughter, king of Egypt's daughter. That's where it all started. And where it leads is spelt out in chapter 11, verses 1 to 6. So we've looked at the good start side. Now we're beginning to look at how things went horribly wrong. Chapter 11, verses 1 to 6. King Solomon, however, loved many foreign women beside Pharaoh's daughter. He wasn't the only one. Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites. They were from nations about which the Lord had told the Israelites, "You must not intermarry with them, because they will surely turn your hearts after their gods." Nevertheless, Solomon held fast to them in love. He had 700 wives of royal birth and 300 concubines, and his wives led him astray. As Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father had been. He followed Ashtaroth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. So Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not follow the Lord completely, as David his father had done. There are three bad things that Solomon did here. The first one was, he took foreign wives. There was an excess of sensual pleasures. There were politically motivated alliances. Second bad thing he did was to build up large levels of personal wealth. He built the temple and his palace at huge cost. He used forced labour of minority groups in his kingdom. There was very heavy taxation of all his subjects. And the resentment that all those things caused boiled over in his son's reign. And especially, by the way, that the northern tribes, the 12 tribes of Israel, were financing a lot of construction was going on the southern end of the kingdom. What happens later on is that there's a split. And the northern 10 tribes go off with a new king, and Rehoboam, Solomon's son, is just left with the southern two. Okay. So he builds up large levels of personal wealth at the expense of his subjects. And the third bad thing he did, so foreign wives, large levels of personal wealth, and verse 4, worshipping foreign gods led astray by those foreign wives. The Israelites had been explicitly forbidden from doing those three things back in Deuteronomy chapter 17, verses 16 and 17, where it says, "The king, moreover, must not acquire great numbers of horses for himself, or make the people return to Egypt to get more of them. For the Lord has told you, you are not to go back that way again. He must not take many wives, or his heart will be led astray. He must not accumulate large amounts of silver and gold." Those were written 500. Those words were written 500 years earlier, when they didn't have a king, right? And it's as if they were written specifically for Solomon, for Solomon's consumption. Now, there's nothing wrong with foreign wife now. But then God explicitly forbade the Israelites from taking foreign wives. Yeah, Yeah, I can see an implication there that, you know, we just need to head that one off before people draw an application that is not warranted, right? The roots of the problem lie right back at the beginning. Solomon was a both-and man. Verse 2, he built the temple of the Lord. But verse 1, and he married Pharaoh's daughter. He showed his love for the Lord by walking according to the statutes of his father David, except that he offered sacrifices and burned incense on the high places. That's verse 3. Okay? He's a both-and kind of man. He both loved God and sacrificed at the high places to other gods. He was someone who did a lot of things right, but he kept a foot in both camps. He kept his options open. He reflects much of the culture that we live in today. It's all right to do a bit of this and that, but skepticism is the order of the day. Don't commit. Wholeheartedness is really frowned upon. The only absolute is that there are no absolutes. And all this happened to Solomon despite his great wisdom. And here's a key thing. Wisdom is no substitute for obedience. Wisdom is no substitute for obedience. We can rationalize and explain away an awful lot of things if we choose to, but they will catch up with us eventually. Wisdom can't save you where disobedience is involved. A disobedient life will be a troubled life. Verse 4. His heart was diverted as he grew old. He started out well, but he wasn't careful to obey fully. And that didn't seem to matter at first. He got away with it. Great blessing came his way. But later on, his both-and approach caught up with him. He was no longer wholeheartedly devoted to God. Verse 6. So Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not follow the Lord completely. And there were consequences. Three I have particularly to lay out to you. The first is, God became angry with him. Chapter 11, verses 9 to 11. The Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who'd appeared to him twice. Although he'd forbidden Solomon to follow other gods, Solomon did not keep the Lord's command. So the Lord said to Solomon, since this is your attitude and you have not kept my covenant and my decrees which I commanded you, I will most certainly tear the kingdom away from you and give it to one of your subordinates. Despite the fact that God had appeared to him twice, he forgets God's provision and presence. Great leaders constantly remind followers of great things so far and spur them on to what is to come. And God tells us to keep remembering. Well, that's one of the things that Solomon failed to do. Here are a few examples from the Israelites wandering in the desert after coming out of Egypt, as recorded in the book of Deuteronomy. Remember the day you stood before the Lord. Chapter 4, verse 10. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt. 5:15. Remember how the Lord your God led you. 8:2. Remember the Lord your God, for it's he who gives you the ability to produce wealth. 8:18. Remember this and never forget how you provoked the Lord your God to anger in the desert. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt. Anyway, you get the idea. God tells us to keep remembering. So look out for fresh testimony. Be ready with stories of what God has done. Don't forget, like Solomon. Remind yourself of God's faithfulness. So that's the first consequence. God became angry with him. The second consequence for Solomon was a whole load of enemies. You'll find these in chapter 11 and verses 14 to 25 if you want to follow it, if you're getting bored with me speaking and just want to read the passage. But in verse 14, you'll see that the Lord raised up against Solomon an adversary, Hadad the Edomite. Verse 23, and God raised up against Solomon another adversary, Rezin, son of Eliada. And verse 26, also Jeroboam, son of Nebat, rebelled against the king. Which in many ways, that's the most important one. God raised up these adversaries, and as a direct consequence of Solomon's disobedience, Solomon was no longer blessed with peace. So we have God getting angry with him, we have the enemies, and the third consequence of Solomon's both-hand approach was loss. Chapter 11, verses 26 to 35. I won't read it for the sake of time, but in that section, Ahijah the prophet prophesies that Jeroboam will be given 10 of the 12 tribes of the kingdom. And after Solomon's death, his son Rehoboam almost immediately loses those northern 10 tribes. From then on, when you read of Israel, it is actually the northern kingdom, the 10 tribes. And Judah refers to the southern kingdom of two tribes, Judah and Benjamin, under the rule of David's heirs. And from then on, the kingdom is always divided. The king with a divided heart will rule a divided kingdom. So those are the consequences for him. Let's move on to application. Here are 5 pointers for running your race in life well for the long term. Number 1, love God above all things and worship him wholeheartedly. Solomon, as we've said, had a foot in both camps. Love for God and offering sacrifices on the pagan high places. Building the temple and marrying Pharaoh's daughter. You cannot serve two masters. Make your choice. Love God wholeheartedly. And that's about your attitude, not your action. Action comes later. Action should come out of love for God. Not because we're trying to earn his favour or pleasure. It should come out of just love for him. So, my first pointer, love God above all other things. Worship him wholeheartedly. My second pointer, root out potential problems early. The roots of Solomon's problems all started very early on. He took a wife from Egypt. These pulls on him had little effect at first, but over time they diverted him from wholeheartedness. And his wisdom was not enough to save him. And eventually, those problems engulfed him. There's a sandy shore at a place called Or on the western bank of the River Severn. It's at the widest point where the river is nearly a mile wide and hugs the inside of an S-bend on the river. Children can play half a mile out on that nice sandbank. But when the tide turns and the Severn bore comes in, the bank can be covered by 10 feet of water in 90 seconds. It looks nice, but it's a very, very dangerous place to be. 100 years ago, my wife Helen's 7-year-old cousin lost his life on that bank. Some things can look very innocent, but can lead us into deep trouble. We face economic uncertainty. Maybe you're overextended. Maybe you've taken out credit and don't know how to repay it. It can feel overwhelming, like that Severn bore coming in. Nowhere to go, nowhere to turn. Solomon thought he was strong enough to manage his sensual pleasures. But as he accumulated those foreign wives, they got the better of him. He wasn't careful to obey God. And in the same way, we can accumulate the trappings of a good life, but they can get the better of us and lead us away from God. Sometimes, in terms of what we accumulate, it's actually time to say enough. So are there things you need to root out? Are there things you need to address now before they overwhelm you? Are you a both-and person? Do you secretly ride two horses, the Sunday appearance and what's really going on inside? What would your partner or closest friend say about you in a moment of complete honesty? Next application is about building on what you've been given. So we all have talent, some sort of inheritance. But we do need to identify that gifting, to develop it, to exploit it to the full, to use it to build the kingdom of God, to use it to worship the King of Kings. Fourth application, determined to obey God. Wisdom, as I said, is no substitute for obedience. There are plenty of things that can knock us off course. And it takes mental decisions to follow through to keep on track. So, for example, just setting aside time to spend with God, to read the Bible, to listen to him and so on. I find it quite straightforward, particularly working for a church and I've got more time available, I find it quite straightforward praying, asking God for things. Much more difficult is creating the space to spend time listening to God. You actually need both. And don't do it out of as an obedience thing, you know, I should do this. Do it out of love for God. Yeah? It's the relationship with him that these other things should flow out of. And as you do that, and as you do things out of love for God, you recognise what he's done for us, and you love him as he has first loved us. And the final application is about accountability. David had the prophet Nathan to tell him when he'd overstepped the mark with Bathsheba. There is no one mentioned in the Bible to hold Solomon accountable. Now, to be accountable, you actually also need to have a soft heart. Otherwise, people won't dare say anything. I suspect one of the things with Solomon was that nobody dared say anything. Nathan literally took his life in his hands when he went to David and told him what he'd done wrong. Yeah, literally took his life in his hands. But David has a soft heart. You know, David, as soon as it was said to him, responded positively. You have to not only be willing to be accountable, but you also have to have a soft heart, ready to respond. We need people who have favour with us. So if there is something that God's prompting you about, find someone that, first of all, you can work it through, and secondly, can hold you accountable to make sure that that you don't step back into whatever that area is. So in conclusion, Solomon started well. He acknowledged God's sovereignty and his inexperience. He built God's temple, and he brought peace and prosperity. A good start. But he did not finish well. He failed to root out problems straight away. He was a both-and kind of man. He disobeyed God directly in taking foreign wives. And he built the temple and palace at huge costs, leading to social problems and resentment, and ultimately the loss of most of his kingdom. So let's finish this message with some challenges. As I read out these challenges, I'd like you to just sit quietly, perhaps shut your eyes, and think about your life, and consider them. You may find God brings to mind some things that you need to work through, you need to go away and address with people, maybe things that you just need to say sorry to God for. So let's just shut your eyes and sit quietly as I just read out these challenges for us. What sort of life are you building for yourself? Do you address problems or hide from them? Do you have a foot in several camps? Do you love God wholeheartedly?